Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome to Pollock and Thurston here on a special Thursday edition of the show. No, we have not been bumped due to the Olympic coverage on our YouTube channels, but we are here building our whole week around the TKO Q2 earnings report and an 8 a.m. call with analysts.
Yes, I did try to bid on the Olympics rights for the WrestleNomics YouTube channel, but they didn't respond to my emails.
Well, I mean, these are things to aspire to, you know. Me and Brandon have been talking. We have these two screens and all this inventory. I mean, we could just be filling this with logos, Wingstop, energy drinks, spirits. We're not slowing down. Okay. We are going to be very, very aggressive. Hey, you've got coffee? Do you need a coaster? Like, listen, guys, we're open for business here on Pollock and Thurston. I will say there is nothing that wakes me up more than Mark Shapiro at 8 a.m. This is the most energetic man at that hour, bar none.
Yeah.
You haven't come around yet, I think, to the Mark Shapiro, but he's to me he's the life of these calls.
Yes. And we noticed, Ari Emanuel had some prepared remarks, as they call them. Do you think he was there in the room though?
No. No, I don't.
No, I don't think he's there.
They did disclose that Mark Shapiro and Andrew Schleimer are in Paris. You would think Ari is probably over there too. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. I was sort of asking around, and this is the second call that's been like this with the TKO CEO appearing to have canned remarks and then leaving it to the CEO and the CFO. There's some impression when, you know, Endeavor was and still is public and they're going private, that Ari was not coming off well in their investor calls, and that maybe that's part of the reason. But it does seem like Mark Shapiro has really been delegated the leadership of TKO here.
Could there be a breakdown of words per call of Ari Emanuel now that we have several TKO calls to compare?
I did that once for, I did like a chart of who was saying the most words over time.
Yes. This is very popular. Strong
and passionate reaction when I shared that publicly.
Yeah. I think the next one, maybe AI can help you with this. You can also grade like tone. and determine, yes, was this an optimistic tone? Was there pessimism? Was there concern conveyed with these projections? I mean, maybe this is the evolution of how we can truly get to the bottom of vibes on the call.
Yes, that's a good idea. I'll have to meet with my friends, ChatGPT and Gemini later.
Well, we're gonna park the conversation about the TKO call because we're gonna be joined in a little bit with Patrick Ogier, who is returning from the Fight Game podcast. He'll be chatting with us a bit about the call. Brandon and I will also share some of our thoughts on the earnings report, but we're gonna start off with multiple developments over the past couple of days as it relates to the Janelle Grant case, which for a case that is technically on a stay, still generating a lot of news, a lot of headlines. 3 weeks ago. Feels longer, but it was only 3 weeks ago that Janelle Grant and her team had filed a petition seeking the electronic medical records from Peak Wellness, a facility in Connecticut that she attended or was being treated at beginning in 2019 under the care of Dr. Carlin Kolker. And in this request for records, Janelle Grant had outlined a lot of improprieties that she alleged she underwent while here, including being administered pills and IV infusions that she was not told about, and painting a picture that a lot of treatment was not being, they were not being transparent with her, that the records she was given were inaccurate and incomplete, even mentioning the fact that there was pushback from Dr. Kolker on several instances, him randomly bringing up when it came to a payment issue, asking Janelle Grant, is this about the NDA, Janelle, in reference to the NDA that was signed between Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant. And this past week, we got Dr. Carlin Kolker's pretty lengthy response to all of these assertions, and to make it as simple as possible, is denying any improper treatment was administered, and he himself is now seeking documents from Janelle Grant. They've filed their own petition seeking this information, which they believe will pretty much prove that all of Grant's claims are baseless, that she was given all of these records. So right at the heart of the matter, Brandon, is Janelle Grant's side stating, hey, we need these medical records. And Kolker's side is stating, you have tons of records and now you need to produce them. So we can't even agree if records have been shared in completion.
Yes, and he's denying all the allegations, essentially, that Grant made in her I want to call it, so it's not a lawsuit.
No.
There's no lawsuit between these two parties, at least not yet. That may not be the case.
It feels we're at the doorstep of a lawsuit. Like it would be, it seems like Kolker's side is kind of getting their ducks in a row here because, I mean, they're flat out claiming, you know, reputational harm, damages that they are stating could be in the tens of millions of dollars of the harm that has been done to the clinic and to Dr. Kolker. So, I mean, you certainly see where this is going. But yes, to Brandon's point, this is not – neither side is suing the other at this point.
Yeah. He's referring to defamation, tortious interference with business relations, negligent and intentional infliction of emotional distress on Dr. Kolker. I guess the notion is that – her filing of the petition to obtain medical records from his clinic that has generated a lot of publicity, press reports from lots of outlets, including ours, about how she was allegedly treated at Peak Wellness. And Dr. Kolker and Peak Wellness have filed this is a separate case to obtain communications records, mainly what we're looking for here. Communications records from Grant and her representatives between anything from any conversations that they had about Peak Wellness or Dr. Kolker, including communications that they've had with news outlets. They also want to depose Janelle Grant at Dr. Kolker's lawyers' offices. So that's what's happening there. We should mention that these petitions, again, are in state court. And the argument from Vince's side is that this action that you're making in state court is a violation of the federal lawsuit that you filed. The judge ruled on, I believe, Tuesday that this is in fact not, in the judge's opinion, not a violation of the federal case. But we do have comments from Vince's lawyer, Jessica Rosenberg, saying that they're still going to pursue that line of argument.
Yeah, that is the ruling that came down on Tuesday. So that was sort of a precursor to this. And to just catch people up to speed, this was in response, Vince McMahon had filed for a motion arguing that because this stay, both parties had agreed to a stay to allow for the federal investigation to take place, that there should be no discovery going on. There should be no actions related to the civil case. And the McMahon side is arguing that these medical records are going to aid the civil case for the plaintiffs, and therefore this is violating the stay. And as Brandon updated here, the judge, Jeffrey Mayer, ruled on Tuesday that this is not a violation of the stay, and citing that Janelle Grant is seeking this in the Superior Court in Connecticut, and it's not connected to the federal case. So how McMahon's side plans to pursue this, I don't know what the next step is once a ruling has been made by the judge. I guess they can try and appeal this. But that was the, and that led to Wednesday, where we got Dr. Kolker's lengthy response. This was about 15 pages and just adamant denial of any wrongdoing and calling it a smear campaign by Janelle Grant, and also arguing the fact that he is not a defendant in this civil suit that Janelle Grant filed, but because it's such a prominent case and he's now linked to it, this got so much coverage when this should not be, you know, requesting documents should not be a major story, but because of the details and the publicity that this Janelle Grant case has received, now he is linked to all of this and it's affected his reputation.
And by the way, we should mention that Grant has alleged in her petition that Peak Wellness is an office that Vince directed her to go to. This is apparently a clinic that Vince has used and that WWE employees and talent, according to her, have gone to. And we do have the comment from Vince's attorney, Jessica Taub Rosenberg, saying Ms. Grant's attempt to seek discovery in state court despite a stay in federal court exemplifies her consistently deceitful behavior and lack of integrity. We will, per the federal court's order, continue to pursue a court order to stop her. We're not lawyers. I'm not sure how Vince's side is going to continue to pursue that, but they are. And then we have a comment from Ann Callis from Janelle Grant's lawyer saying, quote, the court sided with Janelle and against McMahon in confirming she was within her right to seek her own medical records and data from Dr. Kolker of Peak Wellness is reflecting it on brand to file an attack against a woman formerly in his care. And I think it's worth, you know, asking whether there's any cooperation happening here between Dr. Kolker and Vince McMahon or any side in the federal case. As far as we know, they do have separate representatives. So I did ask Vince's representatives if they were representing Dr. Kolker, and they said no.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of brings everybody up to speed. The key things are that they're Kolker. They are seeking to depose Janelle Grant. They have given them, they have 3 weeks to produce these documents and are also looking for additional relief in law or equity that the court finds justified. So again, not a lawsuit per se, but I mean that they are pushing for a deposition to take place sometime in September involving Janelle Grant. And we don't know what the next step will be from the Grant side in terms of at the core of this, you're going to have, in theory, Grant side saying we do not have all of this documentation that you are claiming. And the other, like, where we are going to have a disagreement just on what documentation exists, because you have two competing theories here.
Yeah, it's easy to see that there might be a lawsuit from Grant and Kolker, vice versa. It sounds like Kolker wants to sue Grant over defamation and the damages that he's claiming that he's suffered because of this becoming a public news story. And you could see Janelle Grant perhaps suing Peak Wellness and or Dr. Kolker because of how she was treated, according to her, at Peak Wellness. It'd be interesting to see too, in the context of defamation, how, if this ends up being a defamation case, with Kolker suing Grant, whether, you know, the question of how much of a public figure is Dr. Kolker. He's a celebrity doctor. He authored books. He's appeared on TV. He's appeared in, Bigger, Stronger, Faster, the documentary, which a lot of people would know him from. I'm not sure how much of a public figure he is. I think it might be debatable.
Yeah, it's sometimes not always that cut and dry. I would say this
does have a Wikipedia page.
I think that's the barometer of a public figure. So that's yeah, that is where that case stands at this point. I'm sure we are going to have updates. I don't think it's going to be a quiet period before this stay is set to expire in December. It feels like this is still moving forward, and we will see what the next steps are here, because it's kind of, the ball is now in Janelle Grant's side of how they respond to this, and if we in fact see any lawsuits filed either way between the two parties. Let's chat a bit about the earnings call from today. TKO, their second quarter, announcing a record-setting quarter with revenues combined between the entities of over $851 million and net income of over $150 million. And as a result, they have increased their revenue target for the year up to $2.745 billion for 2024. WWE having a quarter that generated nearly $457 million just this quarter, which, to put into context, it took them until 2007 to generate that amount of revenue in an entire year. And they're now doing that in a quarter. And this was, well, first of all, Brandon, just some of your takeaways of some of the breakdowns between the WWE and UFC businesses.
This was, I think it's notable that UFC usually in these periods, and we've got a table here if you're watching in video that's sort of breaking it down, that UFC and WWE, they generate comparable revenue, and it's usually the case that WWE is generating a little bit more revenue than UFC, but UFC is a little bit more profitable than WWE. In this quarter, this is a period that we're talking about today that's going to run from April 1st through June 30th, and actually for the first time in all of the data that we really have that they're showing us going back to 2022, they do show WWE being a little more profitable than UFC, with adjusted EBITDA is their metric that they're actually disclosing by company here. We don't get deeper than that. We don't get into EBITDA. We don't get into net income for these companies, but we do get adjusted EBITDA. Do you know what adjusted EBITDA is? It is net income, which is the most final form of profit, minus, or excluding, I should say, taxes, net interest, depreciation, amortization, equity compensation, that is the massive stock awards that people like Dwayne Johnson are getting, merger and acquisition costs, certain legal costs, including lawsuit settlements to the tune of $335 million, perhaps, whether or not that happens, restructuring, severance and impairment charges, and certain other items. When applicable, basically anything you don't want to include here for the sake of creating some kind of performance metric, I guess, is kind of what this is, maybe more than a profit metric. Anyway, WWE in their view is a little more profitable in this quarter than UFC for the first time, right, in this entire timeline here, going back to the beginning of 2022.
So this settles the pro wrestling versus MMA debate that began, at the beginning of time, this quarter, answering that question for everyone. This was a very big quarter, basically for both companies, because with WWE, you had WrestleMania baked into this. You also had a card in Saudi Arabia with the King and Queen of the Ring. UFC held four numbered pay-per-view events, two of them giant shows with UFC 300 and UFC 303. And we learned of Brandon's favorite disclosure, site fees. They did share that for UFC's first card in Saudi Arabia, which was a fight night event, they received a $20 million site fee for the June event and a meaningful fee for its UFC 302 card at the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey at the beginning of June. And site fees were
which is $5 million, right?
That's right. We did know that figure as well. A meaningful site fee equals $5 million. So if you're at home, keep track of what these words correlate to. But yes, they continued to talk about site fees. There was a mention by Mark Shapiro about Ari Emanuel's vision of festivizing its events, which are...
Is it festivizing or festivalizing?
Festivalizing would be the term, yes. I don't think that's in the dictionary, but it is in TKO's. It's kind of the F1 formula that, yes, you have a race, but you build all these shoulder events around it and you sell it to various places that are willing to bring them in. And I think that leads a lot of insight into why SmackDown is staying on Friday nights. And we're seeing the addition of these stage shows like we saw at SummerSlam. They did like three of them this past week at SummerSlam. And I think with UFC trying to expand as well, so that you bring in an event, but it comes with all of these other opportunities for these sites to allow you to separate with your money and buy tickets to multiple events per weekend.
Yeah. And WWE's live events, I think, is an interesting story. It's helped by the fact that WWE tickets are more in demand now and they have reduced the supply. Granted, that's over an entire geography of the United States and Canada, the domestic market for the most part, but they are running fewer events. But they're drawing more revenue here. And I've tried, if you're watching in video, to subtract out all the Saudi Arabia money, all the WrestleMania money in each of these quarters. And even if you subtract out those, which especially the Saudi Arabia events are in different quarters from year to year, you still end up with a growing segment. And they don't tell us anymore. We've lost so much information here. They don't tell us anymore what the profitability rate is of the particular segment. So we don't know anymore, you know, is the live event segment profitable? They don't tell us that anymore, but it's probably more profitable, and they're running fewer events, and they're running, obviously they're charging more, they're charging higher ticket prices for WWE events. And it's probably just the realization of what Mark Shapiro talked about a while ago, in that, you know, in certain C&D markets, they might not run shows there anymore or as often. I was even looking at July when I was doing my, you know, look back on July. There were international house shows in July. There were no domestic house shows in July.
And when they rolled out that fall schedule recently, I don't think they listed any, there were no house shows listed at all through the end of the year as well.
Right.
Like, they are going to be few and far between. And I think they're going to be largely international shows, and probably you'll still do your post Christmas house shows of that run of shows, but house shows are going to be, I think, very selective of when and where they run them. And I think that that's only going to continue, where it's creating this scarcity to see a WWE product in your city.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big differences still remains between WWE and UFC is the difference in sponsorship revenue. I think that's the difference between the difference that WWE is able to get in consumer products and licensing, which is probably driven by games and merchandise, and other replica belts. Are replica belts not a big seller? When you go to a UFC event, do you see a lot of people walking around with replica belts like you do at WWE events? I don't think so. There's those things, but also sponsorship revenue. And you look at that and say, wow, that's a great opportunity for growth for WWE. And that's what analysts have been saying for years, is that there's a great opportunity here in Endeavor, and the Endeavor flywheel should really help with that. We're still in this quarter, sponsorship was like a third of what UFC's sponsorship revenue is. And I always want to ponder about that. Like, is it just because it's fake wrestling and people don't want to advertise as much, even though UFC has all of its brand connotations around violence and whatever else? That's still a big difference for WWE versus UFC.
Well, this topic did come up during the earnings call, and I thought this was one of the greatest questions posed to Mark Shapiro, was if they feel that they need to kind of take a step back when it comes to the on-screen sponsorships for WWE. Is there going to be any slowdown of sponsorships? And just listen to the pause as Mark Shapiro gives this absolutely no thought at all that they will be slowing things down.
Just wanted to see if you could dig into your strategy in terms of limiting those in-ring sponsors for now to the biggest events you have, and how you see that building out over time.
We don't see any limitations, frankly. It's all about price. If you want to be in the ring, if you want center canvas, you know, you want to be in the corners, you want to be the clock when it comes to the UFC. I mean, we are out there. Grant Norris and Luke Coscavalis are, of course, you know, running the combined global partnerships group. We are out there talking to new categories. We are out there talking to traditional categories, and we're open for business. I would say these two and their teams are get about as creative as any league I've ever seen. And we're open to anything, frankly. I mean, we're not, you know, looking to over commercialize it. And certainly we're definitely never going to cheapen the brand. But at the end of the day, we're the league, you know, we're the commissioner. We have total control. We're constantly shucking and jiving with these guys, pivoting on what's working for you and what's not. What else do you want? What else can we create for you? And of course, usually when we're moving or changing something in the contract, that comes with an increase.
What can we do for you? And that comes with a bill at the end of things. Yes. We are the league. We are in control. I don't know if those are things that, you want Richard Boulware to hear too loudly, but, no slowdown of sponsorships. If there is space on that canvas, your logo can fill that space.
He mentioned the clock. I'm not hearing this audio, by the way, but luckily I listened to it earlier, but he mentioned the clock. Are they doing sponsorships on the clock for UFC on screen?
I think it depends on, event by event. I think there have been times, that the clock has been sponsored, but I don't think it's a regular occurrence. I'm drawing a blank on.
I would think there's maybe ways that WWE, because they're not bound to, you know, this rigid set of rules that you have in a legitimate sport. If there are ways that they could, you know, create more inventory. I'm thinking of things like in these in-ring introductions that we have. I mean, you could have a sponsor on this lower third, for example. Here we have a screenshot of Liv Morgan being introduced on SummerSlam. And there's no clock in on WWE anyway. I guess maybe there's a way that you could put that on screen, or is there? You know, it's been like, it's sort of a Vince McMahon thing to push away all these sports like elements, including time limits. You know, I feel like if Bill Watts had won the wrestling war, we would have had time limits be an ingrained part of pro wrestling at this point. But I think there are a lot of sports like elements that you would think creatively it would behoove you to reintegrate into your content. Because it does, I think it might drive more live viewership, and you're creating inventory for ads and sponsorships.
We're getting a bit of a choppiness, Brandon. Do you want to maybe just jump out of the room and jump back in? And that might correct the issue. It's just, it's coming and going. But yeah, I would state that the call that Mark Shapiro and Andrew Schleimer, were hosting, this did have some really interesting answers attached to it, some of which we can get into, Brandon, when he returns here. But there was a question as it regards the UFC pay-per-views. And what was brought up when they discussed the pay-per-views was Mark Shapiro disclosing on his own, volunteering this information, that they do believe ESPN was very aggressive and went a bit quicker and higher when it came to the pricing of these UFC pay-per-views than they would have preferred. It's been almost like clockwork every year that these prices have been going up. And when that deal began with ESPN in 2019, the pay-per-views, as you can state here, were $59.99. They have grown $20 by then. There has also been increases in the subscription price, which ESPN Plus is about to go through another price hike along with Disney Plus and Hulu. And yeah, this was just interesting to hear, Brandon, of the fact that this is your broadcast partner. And they stated, yeah, this is not our call to be increasing it. And they even sat down and had a meeting with Jimmy Pitaro about this. And the compromise was allowing for this promotion where several weeks out, and this I think only began this past quarter, where you could order a UFC event several weeks in advance for a discount. The problem with that being, one of those cards was, had you bought this Conor McGregor Michael Chandler fight several weeks earlier, that was not the fight you were getting by the end of it. And it does become a bit of a gamble when you're buying a UFC event several weeks in advance, and injuries or other issues.
Can you get a refund?
I don't think it works so easily. But yes, this was you couple that with like some interesting pointed lines from Dana White at a recent press conference about production gaffes on ESPN side, and it's you know, it just sounds like a company that they're committed to their broadcast partner, but they're also not opposed to seeing what's out there, seeing what the landscape is like as well.
And he mentioned that piracy, their piracy numbers are, I don't know what his phrase
jacked
was,
up,
through the roof.
Jacked up.
Yeah. I wonder, I'm curious how they're measuring that. But anyway, I think, you know, at the risk of, like, you know, projecting my own experience, I have signed up most recently for a VPN through NordVPN.com/postwrestling. And, you know, that I wonder, you know, how, you know, proliferated that behavior is, but it does sort of bring us towards a more global world. Maybe that we're going to be in the future where it's going to be harder to genuinely geo-block things. Because you can, I heard you can get a great price in Malaysia. I think it is for UFC pay-per-view.
A lot of fight fans in Malaysia. Yeah. So that like that aspect was brought up, and it is interesting to look at that. You know, we don't get any kind of transparency on UFC pay-per-view buys any longer. So a lot of it, like you've kind of taken a big chunk of UFC's business that you're just going based on what you see in terms of television numbers or like live events. They're killing it, but as evidenced recently by the Jake Paul fight with Mike Perry, Nate Diaz and Jorge Masvidal, these were tremendous live event successes, but bombed on pay-per-view. And granted, it's a big difference when you're talking about a UFC promoted event as opposed to a non UFC promoted event. But again, like, what are these pay-per-view numbers? And it did sound contradictory when they stated, you know, the piracy rates are getting jacked up, but we are sustaining our pay-per-view numbers. I'm like, those are really competing statements that you're making. It's just
everything's up. The piracy is up. The purchases are up.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe they need to take a lesson from like Ticketmaster and StubHub, and they've got to buy out some of these, piracy sites and work out some way to manipulate this. So they get something out of this. They can sell ad revenue on these pirated sites. Yes. But yes, that was our interesting discussion about the pay-per-view model for UFC fans. It is not cheap to be a UFC fan, and I'm sure that is driving many to find other ways to watch these shows, which I'm sure there's a non-insignificant amount doing so.
Yeah. We did have Sphere conversation here as well. I was looking earlier today at what the numbers are, because WrestleTix has done an estimate. This is from at least a few days ago, but the estimate of tickets distributed is over 12,000, just under 13,000, 12,728. And I was just trying to do a conservative estimate because if you look at the ticket prices, like right now, the lowest ticket price is over $1,000. If you just did a conservative estimate and said, well, let's imagine the average ticket is $1,000 somehow. And maybe there's tickets that have already gone that were under 1,000. And let's say like 10,000 of these have actually been sold. You're already at a $10 million gate. However, as was talked about on this call, this is going to be a really expensive show.
This is not for the average fan out there that wants to go check out UFC Noche, which they did state is getting the largest single event sponsorship ever by Riyadh Season. It's not Mickey's Fine Malt Liquor that is sponsoring this particular event or Condom Depot. But yes, this is going to be more expensive, they stated, than originally thought. It's going to be very pricey. But as Dana White said, you can't look at the dollar figure. You have to look at the value we're going to get out of this. And I think the ticket sales really do reveal, as crazy as these tickets are going to be priced, there's 15,000 people that will feel that this is priced accordingly, and they're going to buy these tickets. And I think it's the draw of this card is just the venue itself, even above any of the 10 fights that they have announced for it.
He talked about how there's value in having this show, even if it's really expensive. He sort of talked about it like it's a marketing value of having this experience of having a UFC show at the Sphere, and presumably the visual elements that'll be involved, that there's some sort of long-term value in just doing this show now.
Well, we will see down the road the value that they get. Maybe we'll get Dana White coming out at the beginning, like Paul Levesque, for one of these shows to give everybody the welcome.
Yes, he should open every show. I don't know why he doesn't.
It's unfortunate. All right, we're gonna welcome in our guest now, Patrick OJ from the Fight Business Podcast, to chat about all things TKO. Patrick, how many tickets have you scored to UFC Noche? Are you gonna just gonna buy a big block of them?
Nah, a little too rich for my blood. Although I will say, Dynamic pricing actually went down on this one. I know when they first came out, cheapest was around 2,700. And so they've dropped to about half price from when people, got the pre-order slash first day of sales. So that's interesting. It's the first time I've seen a UFC event where the dynamic pricing has worked against the company instead of the fan, where they've actually dropped compared to where they were.
Do you feel this will be the final UFC campaign stop for Donald Trump on the way to November? I think he has to appear at this one.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I would agree with that, especially given where his campaign currently is and the relationship he has with Dana White and the, yeah, I can't, maybe, I would bet money he's there.
Maybe it could be a compromise and this could be where one of the debates is.
There you go. Yeah. And then, you know, you can look at the both of them debate by, you know, sticking your head all the way back up to see the giant screen. It'll be perfect.
All right. We should be deferential here. Dana White did state on the record to CNN, he's not political. So we really shouldn't drag politics into UFC discussion. Okay. He's not political. Today was the earnings call, Patrick. It was a record-setting quarter as they trumpeted for Q2. It, a lot of big cards being staged. What were some of your big takeaways from today's call and kind of just taking a look at TKO's health that appears to be in very good shape? As Mark Shapiro stated, I don't think we could be a cleaner story.
Yeah, no, this was a big quarter for them. A great call. I mean, the stock reflects it too. I think last I saw it was about $7 or so, like so close to 7-8%, something like that. But yeah, I mean, the biggest takeaways for me were UFC revenue jumped in every category except for consumer products. And they've got a margin of about 60% at this rate. UFC 300 and 303, as well as WrestleMania, were huge events for them. And this is always the quarter that they've said, you know, it was going to be their biggest quarter given the convergence of those three events, and that this shouldn't be a quarter that you look for every single quarter. You need to look for the whole year guidance because of that. But the fact that they did raise guidance up $60 million on both the low and high end says something. The $100 million in excess savings from synergies, I think, was huge. That was a target, right? 50 to $100 million. In terms of savings through basically reduction, they're not going to say it on the call, but through staff reduction and, kind of, you know, merging part of the back office of WWE and UFC together. They've expect to now exceed that. I think in the sponsorship area too, I forget if it was Ari, or not, but they kind of caught themselves saying that there's room for sponsorship, in terms of headroom. I think he almost said headcount in terms of reduction there. But those are the biggest takeaways for me, is that their costs are going down. They're saving more money on costs than they thought. Again, strong forecasted advance sales. And then lastly, another huge takeaway for me is, I think in this call, they kind of spelled out that they're looking to go more and more global. They're probably looking to reduce domestic events in terms of both UFC and WWE, just, you know, whether it's house shows or traveling fight nights, those things, I think those will be reduced. And I think they'll look more and more to do kind of a global type of push to do things like Backlash France, you know, Saudi Arabia events. They'll do more UFC fight nights in Paris, things like that. I think that's a huge overtone of this entire call. And the New Zealand test on Netflix kind of speaks to that too, where a lot of people say Netflix wasn't in the UFC media rights running. I think that can be kind of definitively put to rest now.
You might be muted, Brandon.
Sorry, there I am. Let's really bore people. They've raised their target on revenue. They've raised their target on adjusted EBITDA. They have reaffirmed, not changed, their target on free cash flow. And the other thing I notice is that I assume it's largely due to merger costs, but their 6 month, I have it here somewhere, their 6 month rate of net income is still negative. So this is, I think, coming out of a lot of costs related to the merger, but eventually will be genuinely very profitable.
Yes, I would agree. I think this is still a cleanup of merger costs, as well as you know, I'm assuming some of these bigger names that I've seen cut from WWE are getting pretty nice severance packages. I'm assuming that as they do these package deals, and they do big marketing events like UFC Noche and kind of take some of these, costs, I think it's mostly merger costs that are still lingering and that eventually it will lead to very, very big profitability.
We also have like the latest developments in the antitrust cases, and they did address this in their filings, part of their statement noting that they are evaluating all of their options, including without limitation, an appeal, and has also initiated discussions with the plaintiffs' counsel, who have expressed a willingness to engage in separate settlement discussions for the Kung Lee and Cajun Johnson cases. I wouldn't say this was like a big topic on the call, but I guess what is your sense just in terms of the concern of a trial, and should there be concern of a trial versus just the paying this nine figure settlement fee and making these cases go away permanently?
Yeah. So from my take on this is I've seen a lot of people, you know, kind of tout this as a victory for the plaintiffs because essentially the judge said, this is too low. I'm worried about some of the, you know, justice being done here, especially for the Johnson case. But something to keep in mind is that you just had a court overturn the NFL Sunday Ticket settlement. And a huge basis of that was the fact that some of the math and supporting evidence didn't really add up here in terms of the economics and formulas that they were using. When it comes to the UFC antitrust case, this is really unique, novel type of calculations and formulas that have been evaluated and criticized by both the plaintiff, the defense counsel, as well as other economists, where even if things go the way of the UFC fighters here and they end up winning, let's say they get $1.6 billion with the treble damages, that's a huge win for them. There is a solid chance, especially now that the precedent has been set with the NFL case, that this will go to appeal and get overturned. Just because some of the economic theory here is untested, and it wouldn't shock me at all, given Judge Boulware's understanding of antitrust law and some of his understanding of the math, that it could easily get overturned. So I think that's reflected in the stock price, right? You had a slight dip when it was announced that the settlement was rejected. But since then, it's really been just up and away for the TKO stock. And I think it's more at risk for the fighters, especially the Johnson case, because now you have to go do separate discovery. A lot of those contracts post 2017 have a class arbitration and a class waiver in their suit. So that's really where the impact would come, is if they could end up getting some changes to contracts moving forward. That's going to be a whole separate trial now. So I think at this point, there's more to fear on the plaintiff side than the UFC side. And I think they know that. They may raise, you know, the settlement cost and just try and be done with it, so you take away that ambiguity. But I view it more as a risk towards the plaintiffs. Higher reward, but far higher risk now that we're looking at possibly going to a trial.
Let's talk a little bit about, Brandon and I were just talking about it before you joined us. And that was an interesting discussion that Mark Shapiro shared just about the pay-per-view pricing within ESPN and how aggressive they have been with this pricing. I mean, they were not shy in stating, like, this is very much initiated by Disney and ESPN. It's their right to price this, but there was definitely concerns from us to the point that we sat down and went over this. And when you look at this, I mean, this has been pretty much a yearly increase that you've seen, where the price of being a UFC fan has grown exponentially since this deal began. And as a result, like, their data shows them that piracy is jacked up, as Mark Shapiro stated. And it's more so just interesting that they are putting this out there and not kind of a uniform message with ESPN when it comes to the selling of their product.
Yeah, I think it's been some frustration on the UFC end, especially when you look at not only the pay-per-view increases, but ESPN Plus has also increased quite a bit. I believe they almost doubled in terms of the yearly price just this past June. So you're looking at increases that are going to drive down pay-per-view buys. And from Disney's perspective, right, they're just all about getting ESPN Plus in in the green, which they finally did this quarter ahead of schedule. It was a big marquee part of their earnings call to say, hey, ESPN Plus is profitable. That's where they make the most money. But the arrangement they have with the UFC is that essentially up to a certain number of buys, they get to keep all of the UFC buy or pay-per-view buys, the Disney and ESPN does. And then after a certain buy limit, the UFC then gets some compensation. I forget whether it's 300 or 400,000, something around that range. But so from the UFC's perspective, I'm sure they're frustrated because they're seeing higher piracy, lower buys. And that's still working mathematically for Disney. But now the UFC is hitting, you know, less and less over that threshold. So they're not getting the residuals. So, excuse me. So I think, you know, they called it out because, especially with media rights coming up and, you know, where their relationship is, I think they wanted to kind of signal that to Disney, especially since ESPN Plus is now profitable. You know, I think this is their subtle way of saying, hey, we don't care for this. We're about to enter negotiations next year. Keep that in mind.
Yeah. And you also have to wonder, like, this is, you know, piracy of pay-per-views has always existed. But at this point, are they pushing more fans that are just, this is creating a habit that they do not want to be instilling in their fans that, you know, it doesn't take a genius to be able to figure out how to make your own workarounds. And I'm in Canada, so I don't get ESPN Plus, but man, it's like clockwork every year, every month on a UFC pay-per-view night, the problems people have with this service. I don't know if like you experience these problems, Patrick, but it just seems like ESPN Plus can be a very, it's a struggle to navigate this system, especially when there's a high volume of people watching.
Yes. The system issues with the ESPN Plus are well known and they really haven't gotten better to your point, right? Like they have not put a product team on here to take in fan feedback and to really revamp things. It's kind of, this is how it's always been. And, yeah, I mean, there are multiple issues where I've had times where, you know, a main event just won't load correctly. And I'll end up getting to watch the main event halfway through because of the system having issues. So, you know, driving people more to piracy through price and those system issues also can't be a good thing for the UFC's product and their perspective. So, I doubt ESPN Plus is going to revamp, especially now that you've got the new venue deal coming through with the ESPN TNT and all of that together. But it's been a struggle for anybody who's used ESPN Plus.
I was a little surprised that in the whole course of the call, there was no, you know, question or speculation about how, well, WBD is apparently going to lose the NBA. And does that make the demand for UFC rights even greater?
Yes. I think it's an interesting topic. And I was also surprised that there were no questions about it specifically. I think when they did speak to media rights, again, they've kind of pointed to, they specifically focused on Netflix and that kind of new audience, right? They signaled they're really looking for new top of the funnel type consumers that they will hopefully convert into hardcore fans, get more money generated that way, do more baseline pay-per-view buys, things of that nature. Between that and then Dana White's comments a couple weeks ago, where he spoke about different services and people kind of asking about media rights and kicking the tires, so to speak, talking about the NBA deal and how he could see them being on multiple networks, I think that's their overall goal, is to get something along the same lines of what the NBA has done, whether that's having pay-per-view stream through one service, having, you know, big fight nights on a cable channel that's separate from that, and then doing Apex events as a C package. They've made it clear on this call that what they're really looking for is who has the broadest reach into new audiences, who's going to allow us to reach different markets who have never seen or watched the UFC before, are willing to pay for that and help us convert into hardcore fans. So I think that's kind of their overall hope. Whether or not they actually get that will be, I guess we'll just have to see. But I do expect with WBD losing NBA, they'll at least be in the conversation.
Yeah, and I guess we can mention too that the WBD call was just the other day, and they announced that they're going to rebrand True TV to, I think it's TNT Sports Prime. But I think there's a lot of questions around WBD in general right now, where you had Mr. Zaslav himself saying that they look at their debt as an asset, which is about as close to an oxymoron as I think I've ever heard on an earnings call from a CEO.
That's what every student says coming out of university as well.
Yes.
We can get into WBD after. I don't know. It's above my pay grade to understand how this company functions, but it does.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's just we can close out on this, Patrick. I'm just kind of curious what you see in terms of, you know, once we're looking at, you know, the UFC and where these rights are going to land. Like, if you're looking down the road, do you see a landscape where they can maintain these, like, even in the ballpark of $80 per pay-per-view? Or do you feel like the way all of this is going, that they could, Mark Shapiro even floated the idea of getting a great offer where the pay-per-views become part of this ESPN over-the-top service, that the days of pay-per-view on a monthly basis are, like, it's very lucrative if you can continue it, but is that where the world is going?
That's a great question. I think looking at the current landscape and where things are with media rights and then just sports in general, right? I think getting to a service that would pay and include all pay-per-views and things of that nature is very possible, especially right now. I think the NBA deal kind of proved, hey, there is a larger market for live sports than people realize, especially when it comes to advertising, streaming services, trying to get profitable. That's a huge part of it. And the more that these streaming services move towards these ad tiers, right, is because you can still get ad-free tiers in a lot of these, but you have to pay significantly more. They want people more on the ad tiers. That's what they prefer. The more that happens, the more likely someone is going to say, okay, in order to secure our streaming ad revenue and make sure that we're in a good spot, we need to basically pay the UFC as though every show is going to be 500, 600, 700K pay-per-view buys. And then it's going to all be included in one. And that way people are going to, you know, continue to sign up for our $15, $20 a month streaming service that we'll keep raising the price of, and we'll keep charging more and more for ads, and it will offset. I think that window is still open as of right now. The interesting thing is, before the NBA and NASCAR rights, some of this stuff this year, right, it definitely seemed like media rights was kind of shrinking and that there might not be these large increases. Depending on where the overall macro economy goes in the next 6 months, by the time some of these negotiations occur, I think that's going to influence whether or not pay-per-view buys stay. If we end up in a situation where, you know, I think Goldman Sachs now is calling for a 25% chance of recession coming to the US. If we hit a recession or even a mild pullback on the US side, I think pay-per-view stay, because I don't think companies are going to want to deal with, you know, that risk of paying 500, 600K, especially when there's a good chance that pay-per-views will go more and more the way of piracy, and it will be treated more of a, you know, luxury for those who are, you know, not having as much disposable income. If the economy keeps chugging along and things are good, I think you could end up with that deal in 2025. I think it's going to be a big hindrance on, hinder a lot on the macro economy.
Yeah, it seems like one of the conversations that I think Nick Khan has brought up a lot about why, you know, the story about why boxing became less popular into the 80s, 90s, and forwards, because you put all of your best content on pay-per-view behind a whatever it was, $50 paywall, $100 paywall. And I would think there's an opportunity for UFC is their best content, their pay-per-view stuff, in front of a larger audience and expose it to all that reach that would have downstream effects for their other businesses.
Yeah, I would agree. And you'd think, again, the way they talked on this call, wanting new consumers, looking at something like Netflix or what Dana White said of that vision of Channel 2, 3, 7 globally and wanting to be on Channel 3 and dominating that, you would think that they would not want to put it behind the pay-per-view. But part of the issue is right now, pay-per-view is a great variable revenue stream that you have a lot of control of, where if the UFC can get 400K, you know, as a base deal for pay-per-view buys per event, and then a residual after that, and you have Disney, you know, pushing what they're doing, it's hard to see a world in which, you know, it's truly worth it to get rid of pay-per-view. Because once you get rid of pay-per-view, I think it's going to be, you know, that's it. You can't really go back.
Yeah, I think that's very clear. It's why it's a big decision for them. As we've seen with WWE, I think they'd really struggle if they ever tried to go back to that. You can catch more of Patrick on the Fight Business podcast. Anything else you would like to throw out there, Patrick?
No, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Hey, we appreciate it very much, Patrick. It's always great to chat with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
All right, everyone, that was Patrick Ogier joining us to chat about the TKO earnings call. And, you know, I don't think Mark Shapiro misspoke. I think when he said headroom, I think he literally means like there's room. We have these heads of all these athletes. What can we put on those heads as well? I think like there's nothing sacred when it comes to sponsorship opportunities.
Yes.
I don't think it struck you as much at SummerSlam was the first time it really like hit me in terms of just like looking down and just it's just this proliferation that and I am not that averse to like sponsorships and the amount of it. I fully understand where they are going towards this, but to be fair, like I don't think audiences bat an eye at any of this stuff. I don't think there's really that. I would imagine like whatever resistance there is, it's minuscule, because that does not seem to be a conversation I see among fans that have any aversion to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think as long as it's fairly passive, you're fine. As long as it's something that is in the background and maybe commentators are making a passing mention of it. It's once it becomes the content, like the zombie battle royal or something like that, which is really tempting and attractive at the corporate level, because they get to talk about how they're integrating all of these sponsors right into the content. I think that's really hard to do well in a way that is not turn off for your fans. But I think there's a lot more that they could do. And I think they're not at the limit of what I think fans can stomach. I think we will see discussions on Twitter about the increase of that. But I think something that was one of my takeaways from SummerSlam is just there are wrestling fans who are not discerning, who were, I mean, we have the economic results through the late 2010s that people did turn away from WWE and became disenfranchised by it. But past a certain level, okay, it's prepared itself largely, and past a certain level, there isn't all of this discerning about what's good and what's bad and what's a turn off in terms of something like, is there too much sponsorship and brands all over the place? I think Cinnamon Toast Crunch, I did have the privilege of sitting there in Pittsburgh, for Payback, where we had Cinnamon Toast Crunch sponsored match. And it was just like, it was on the TitanTron. It was on every surface, and that's over branding. But as long as it's done in moderation, I think they'll be fine.
There was a presenting sponsor for NXT this week, which I can't remember. I mean, maybe it's happened a time or two, but, you know, it just shows you the amount, that they are pushing towards that. Yeah. We'll end off this chat.
The Manscaped thing, I think is approaching the border too.
I thought that one was, that one was crossing certain lines, but they seem to want to at least have fun with it. But, yeah, that was definitely the,
the painful WWE
act. I think if you shoot that in a way that doesn't look like a WWE backstage segment and just shoot it like it's a commercial, that's fine. But to make it look like this is your content that we're giving you and it's an ad, I don't think that works.
Yeah, I cannot imagine that product integration 5 years ago in WWE in terms of how that would have been handled, but better left to people's imaginations. Last clip here from Mark Shapiro talking about the WWE Netflix deal that goes into effect in January.
The Netflix deal for WWE is all about discovery, right? New audiences, new viewership, casual viewers. You're going to go to that front page and WWE is going to be right there being promoted, being marketed. That's a whole new audience for us. The folks that are already fans of WWE, they will follow. It will be appointment. But Netflix will serve to be a real discovery platform with us. And specifically, that will help us, Brandon, when it comes to site fees and sponsorship.
And that was Mark Shapiro answering Brandon Ross, not Brandon Thurston, for those that were maybe confused by that line. But Netflix, it's all about discovery and finding the casual fans, Brandon. And I think this is to your point that this is going to reach a lot of people and it's going to become that much more accessible to people. Of you log on to Netflix and you see WWE as one of the main properties that is advertised on the main page of Netflix. I think that's a great value to them. And I think we're going to really see that ramp up towards the end of this year when the big campaign is on to direct people to Netflix, which in some parts of the world, such as here in Canada, all the WWE programming is going to Netflix as of January. So it's going to be, for a Canadian viewer, like, it's one place to get everything. And that's going to be I think that'll be a big difference maker. And I think everyone is now looking at Netflix. What is their ultimate strategy when it comes to WWE? Is that just dipping their toe in of something even bigger, like a UFC, for instance, of that fitting into their strategy when it comes to kind of the next evolution of what Netflix is going to be?
Well, they're on the right side of the wind here. If we just look at the US market, Netflix is in, they don't break out US from Canada. They report US and Canada together. In fact, they're going to stop reporting all of that soon. But there's something like 60 million Netflix subscribers in the United States. And the top cable networks, including USA, TNT, TBS, all of that, is getting close to that number. We're getting close to the time where those numbers are intersecting, and that the leading streaming service is going to be in more homes than the leading cable networks. And when this deal was announced in January, it took a lot of figuring out, and it's still taking a lot of figuring out, to know exactly what it represents in terms of an increase over what their current TV rights deals are. And it looks to me like it's 30 to 40% of an increase, when, you know, a year prior or so, we were all expecting something like an 80% increase. But the good side has to be, the good part of the story has to be, that Netflix is not only going to give us, you know, a mild increase in cash payments, but that there's going to be all this value that they're going to provide to us in terms of reach, in terms of letting us, you know, get to a bigger audience. Globally, that will be true, right? I think globally, they're going to be, you know, in front of more people than they were in some regions because of the reach that Netflix has, maybe versus their other partners. But in terms of being in front of younger fans, younger people in the United States, that will be true as well. You know, we know how old skewing, 55 and older basically is what traditional TV is. I don't know what Netflix is, but it's got to be a lot younger.
Let's go through a bunch of other topics here. Quickly, just on WBD, we're not going to go through all of their earnings and business, but some of the takeaways here were, they announced that they have incurred a $9.1 billion non-cash impairment charge for its TV network business. I don't care how big of a company you are. That's quite the impairment charge, and the stock reacted accordingly. Their revenue for the quarter was $9.7 billion. And as of June 30th, this company's gross debt is $41.4 billion with $3.6 billion in cash on hand. So they are just swimming in debt. But the bright spot of this
call or report was Max adding 3.6 million subs this quarter, and their global streaming customers are up to over $103 million. So it's a, this is a, certainly it's not to say WBD as a whole is torpedoing, but their television business is certainly under a lot of pain, I shall say.
But what did they announce about AEW? Did they announce a new TV deal?
I don't think he referenced his meeting with Mr. Khan or any AEW discussion was brought up in all of this. Yeah, imagine if he had just like announced a deal right there in the Q&A.
And we have AEW for another 5 years. No, yeah, no, I don't. We're still waiting on that. They had some sort of meeting in Paris. Tony Khan tweeted about it, but no news.
Yeah, they did not sign their own version of the Paris Accord or anything like that. And to our understanding, they are now in the non-exclusive window. So Tony would be free to accept any meetings and discussions elsewhere. So that's the latest there. PW Insider reported today that Kristen Altman, who was came into the company in 2008 as a receptionist and kind of just climbed the ladder in talent relations all the way up to her last role as VP of Talent Relations Operations. And PW Insider reporting that she was let go by the company. I don't know if this is a just cost reduction move. Certainly would not be the only, you know, executive figure that has been let go over this, you know, post-merger period. But someone that had been there quite a bit and in the talent relations department, I mean, that is, you know, a pretty prominent role behind the scenes of at least being in that division and who she was working with.
Yeah, and we know that Crystal Gentle is now overseeing talent relations, so it's unclear if it's related to some reorganization that could be related to that change in leadership or if it's just TKO-related mergers.
UFC announced that their UFC 307 pay-per-view will take place October 5th, so that means we will have a UFC and WWE premium live event going head-to-head. And on the poster, Brandon, I know your eyes would have gone immediately on the poster to see Utah Sports Commission and the Smith Entertainment Group, which there were two prior UFC pay-per-views over the last 2 years where we know that these groups kicked in some fees to bring these shows. And the fact that their logos are present on these posters would indicate that the UFC just they don't just like going to Salt Lake City for the hell of it. I'm sure there is a nice financial incentive to be bringing its third pay-per-view in as many years to Utah. But yes, that will be October 5th, head-to-head with what's the card? Bad Blood in Atlanta.
Okay, I'm reading here that the BMF title will also be on the line.
That was the last card when they were in Utah.
This is last year's. Okay.
Yeah, that was last July. That was their last stop. So that is that's coming up for Utah. And we'll talk about our SummerSlam experience in a minute. Anything you can share about what's going on in your seeking of public records? Is there anything you can share or not yet?
I did get a response yesterday related to WrestleMania in 2022 in Dallas. This is another request that had to go to the Attorney General for review. I have not looked through it except for to notice that some of the tables they gave me are pretty much unreadable. So I've asked them to send that back if they can give it to me in a more readable form. I'm expecting today, I have not received it yet. I'm expecting today some sort of response, some sort of records release related to the San Antonio Royal Rumble. So everybody who's waiting out there, the millions of people who are listening and waiting for the release of information related to the Royal Rumble in 2023, what did the city of San Antonio pay or not pay? We might find out later today. I think that's an update on what's happening so far. I did get, this cuts both ways. Okay. This is not just about seeking records and information about WWE. It's about AEW too. Also staying within the state of Texas, the city of Arlington, which we're in the midst of the Path to All In residency, at the esports arena. As people may know, I reported earlier on the agreement details, the contract details between AEW and the city of Arlington. There was a redaction in part of that contract. One paragraph entirely was redacted. We now know it has been unredacted and released to me. And is everybody ready to learn what it said? The redacted paragraph was about broadcast rights and basically just made sure that AEW guaranteed to still own whatever broadcast out of this venue. For whatever reason, they needed to redact that and make sure that that was reviewed by the AG. They were claiming AEW was claiming that this was proprietary information, until deemed otherwise, went to the Attorney General of Texas, and AEW, in fact, did not even submit a comment to the Attorney General arguing why it had to be protected and deemed proprietary. There was, you know, the city of Arlington made no argument. So it was just released to me unredacted. So it's a pretty mundane paragraph.
Well, there you go. That's, Brandon Thurston's documents. Okay. That's what we're going to call this segment every single week. And, one super chat coming in here. Hello. Should Shad and Tony Khan consider buying a stake in WBD, $7 a share, to help potentially get a AEW deal? Every option should be on the table, is what he has stated. Should they buy their way into a television deal? What if they stage a hostile takeover of WBD?
It's worth less today than it was a couple days ago, so it's only getting cheaper.
Isn't this kind of what Anthem did with Access TV?
Yeah, I would never recommend somebody to look into purchasing a declining asset. That's why buying cars is a bad idea, which is basically what all these TV networks are. They're just big cars that are going to depreciate over time. So it's why it took so long for a Paramount deal to come together, is because this is just, what are we buying here? We're buying something that's largely bound to a declining cable business as people, you know, subscribe to TV less and less. So why buy it? Unless it's for a really, really cheap price.
Yeah. I think the cons will be okay. I don't think they need to buy shares in WBD.
Wouldn't be a good investment.
No, it wouldn't.
But then again, you're in the wrestling business. So
what if Zaslav had told Tony back in Paris, like, hey, you should really load up. We're going to have a big week. How much would he have cost Tony over the last couple of days? I don't even know if that's legal, by the way, but, that's me purely.
That would probably be very, very illegal. Yes.
Yeah. So I David Zaslav would not make such a misstep. That would just be terrible.
No, he values his debt too much.
No. Okay. Let's talk a bit about, SummerSlam. Both of us went down to Cleveland over the weekend. We took in the Cleveland Guardians game with the Baltimore Orioles. And then we went to SummerSlam on Saturday at, Cleveland Browns Stadium. I'm sure Mark Shapiro just shaking his head at the name of that stadium, of like, what is being left on the table here? Cleveland Browns Stadium. How did you enjoy, this outing to your upteenth WWE show that you've gone to? How many have you gone to this year? You've gone to pretty much all the US ones, haven't you, by this point?
Royal Rumble, WrestleMania.
Then they went international till Money in the Bank. So yeah, you've been at all the domestic.
Oh, I was at Money in the Bank too. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Is my feed still okay? Is it better than before?
It's not that bad. It's cutting out intermittently, but it's not terrible. It's
okay.
We're okay.
Okay. I guess just the international ones that I have been at, right? Australia, France, Glasgow.
Yeah. So I guess. When's their next US one? It's not until Bad Blood in
Atlanta, which I have no plans on going to. Yeah. Not planning currently.
Yes. So we were set up in the press box, and when I got there, I got my my media credential, that the dreaded color yellow. I know to expect yellow basically means red, as in stop.
Wasn't it the reverse for Money in the Bank? We got bracelets instead of tags. And I think it was yellow that was permitting you to enter the press conference and not green.
Okay. In my head, it was backwards, but you could be right. So you had access to the press conference. I did not have access to the press conference. Several people alerted me online afterwards of this fact. And, I don't have a whole lot to add to this. I would say that, if you listen to WrestleNomics, which was free this past weekend, I think you summarized pretty much all of my thoughts in your last 15 minutes that I pretty much, agreed with in that sense. Since Sunday or Saturday, I should say. I mean, it kind of is what it is. I think that there is, the idea that, listen, the reason I was given, and I did kind of make my case to try and get into this press conference, was it just comes down to numbers. And I think Brandon and I are kind of paired together now as one entity. And I think in most cases, it's going to be one of us that is going to get in, and that is a suffice. I don't really agree with that, but I think that's kind of the situation we're at right now. And that's kind of it. I think that, as long as one of us is in there, I feel better about that. But, it does certainly, make me think about, you know, just the extra, you know, the cost involved in going to these, and if that's going to be the case, like, is this like the best utilization of, you know, our funds, which is like our listeners are supporting this, and it's more work and it's harder for us to cover these at the stadium, at the arena. When you're like, I'm basically going there for that press conference. That's the unique bit of content or access that I get at these, because being there, it's, like you're there, Brandon. Like, it's not as though it's an environment where you're getting like one-on-one time with any talent or executives or anything like that in the box. It's like, you're just there to watch the show, and then it's the press conference. So that's kind of where I'm at, in terms of that. And it's kind of this crapshoot of whether you're going to have press conference access or not. And I know it's the same for you. Like, you're not, as much as you love to do like play by play of matches, you're mainly there for the press conference as well.
I will say this was a lot like WrestleMania in that there were a lot of people there in the press box. I would say it was comparable in terms of the number of people who were there.
Yep.
The press box even looked similar to the one we were in Philadelphia. So naturally that meant there were a lot of people to want to get into the press conference. We were both let in Toronto.
Yes.
You know, maybe they think of us as belonging to one outlet, and there certainly is a lot of cooperation here. I guess I will say I was happy with a lot of the questions that were asked, and, you know, two out of three of the questions that I was considering were asked by others. But
yeah, we should mention, Sean Ross Sapp asked about the status of Stephanie McMahon, since this was the latest, that we saw her at WrestleMania. We saw her at the Madison Square Garden SmackDown, and then she was there at SummerSlam. And Denise Salcedo also asked about the involvement with TNA working with other companies. So there were some like very good questions that were asked of Paul Levesque after his, 15 minute recap of the event.
Yeah, I guess what I would suggest is that, you know, if I were you and requesting access again, I don't have plans to go until WrestleMania, but to ask that, you know, ahead of time, request access to the press conference specifically and see if you can get a verbal commitment to that. Do you feel that if it was any factor in the question that you asked to John Cena in the Money in the Bank press conference, in which he honored your courage?
Yes, that in fact did happen. For those, the recap,
appreciate the courage,
was uttered. Listen, I can't say that had any impact. Would I be, like, I'm not naive at the same part, and no one has conveyed that to me at WWE. No one at least, voiced any issue with my question, or had, and they credentialed me for SummerSlam. Yes. So I have to go by that. I think it's one of those where I think if there is room, they'll allow me. And I think I'm like, right. Like, I don't know if they're going to like bend over backwards for me, and that's fine. And that's kind of where it is. Like, I don't take any of it as, you know, some, like, I was hardly the only person not allowed into this press conference. Like, there were lots of people, as Brandon mentioned, that were there. So, I mean, it could have played a factor. It might not have played a factor. I don't know.
Now I'll say this. There were lots of people in there. So yes, there's more press than ever here. Well, there's more press than usual here. So, either understand explain that to why you might be left out. Now, there were people from, people who had, you know, like the VIP packages, these on location packages, use this VIP experience. And part of that apparently is that you get to attend the press conference in person. How do you feel about prioritizing VIP pass people over members of the media? in the press conference.
I think it's just bizarre that that is kind of.
I'm trying to ask you every triggering question here.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's. I did get the updates from Brandon about the makeup in the room as it was going on. As by the way, I mean, if there was a silver lining, as soon as I knew we were not in the press conference, Wade and I bolted and left an hour before the show ended. We beat the traffic. We were back in time for the main event at our Airbnb. So there was that. There wasn't the stampede of getting out of that stadium. Listen, it's at its core, this is a WWE event. And if they can make money off these people, God, they would sell all of these seats to people. Sometimes you and I kind of question, like, they just seem to, like, they... I don't know what they necessarily want out of these press conferences, because I think it would be very easy to just go that full route. You could probably sell a lot of these seats to fans, and you could have the fans ask questions, and it would probably be exactly what they want. It tells me they want a degree of serious people in there too, because if not, I don't think you'd be in there. And I think that they do want an
I was not called on, by the way, though.
You were not called.
But I was not called on, which is rare that I'm not called on.
It's rare. Like if I was in that room and I put my hand up and they didn't get to me, I would not be suspicious of that myself. But I mean, you have been someone that it was notable to people that you are always called upon this one. You were not. So again, there's nothing you and I can point to as like a clear indication of that. It is what it is. So that's sort of where, That's sort of where things are at this point. These press conferences, I have definitely hit like the fatigue on like talking about these press conferences, and kind of exhausted of like every press conference I've attended this year has somehow generated some story coming out of it that I'm just not accustomed to.
And the ones we haven't attended,
and the ones we haven't attended as well. So like, there's that aspect to it. I would prefer to just be in a ability where I feel like I, at the very least, I'm not putting myself at the top of the heap, but enough that I think I should be able to have a presence at these press conferences just to be in there. But it's not my decision, and it's on my call. So there's very little I can do.
Two days, I think it came out on Thursday, the interview with Richard Deitch interviewing Chris LeGentle, who's their head of communications and executive vice president of talent relations now, where Richard Deitch brought our names up because we've been doing reporting about the Janelle Grant lawsuit and all that. And we were mentioned by him, and then LeGentle responded saying, yes, he agrees that we do good work and that we're, you know, you see us regularly at their press conferences, which I took to mean he was trying to convey in the context of that interaction with Richard Deitch that they're not avoiding hard questions or difficult issues. You know, most of their press may be positive, but there are some difficult stories that they have to deal with, and they're not running from that. And then 2 days later, after you say that we're regulars at the press conference, to not give you access to the press conference and to give me access, but not have me call, ask a question is, it makes that look, disingenuous, that maybe we're not regulars at the press conference, in fact.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. Like, and many people noted that. It's like, I think, you know, some people took that, and I'm sure there were also many people celebrating as well. If our feedback after our presence last month was any indication and such, but it's sort of this game that goes on. And I don't doubt that there are probably people there that I think appreciate kind of the lane we're in and the work we're doing. And I'm sure that there's people there too that don't care for that and want these to be much more in line with just an extension of the event by an extra 60 to 90 minutes and much closer to that. But as long as they are opening these and calling these press conferences and allowing access to someone like yourself, Brandon, then that's, I mean, there's no confusion over kind of the way we are approaching these. And as long as we are invited to them, we're going to approach it that way. And if they reach a point where they don't want us there, they won't allow us there. But at least,
I just take solace in the fact that at least when you and I go, at least one of us is in there. So that's kind of it for SummerSlam. So until the next press conference drama, that's that.
Before we go, we do have Dynamite ratings.
Oh, we are breaking news.
Pro Wrestling Torch has reported the Dynamite rating, which is 622,000 viewers, a 0.19 in the P18 to 49 demo.
So a small increase in viewership. And
yes, last week was 609, this week 622, and a 0.19 in the demo last week was a 0.18.
Okay. Well, there you go. That is your show going into, well, into the weekend where we have a Collision back in its normal time slot and everything goes back to normal. Collision is back in its time slot this Saturday, and then Raw and NXT move back to the USA Network, next week. And you have to classify this run of WWE programming on Sci-Fi, I would state, as pretty strong when you had Raw outperforming USA on Monday and even NXT, like they held up pretty well, for these two Great American Bash shows. And it really does show you the ability, like that was a tremendous number for Raw. It would have been that much bigger on USA. But I think this move to Sci-Fi, it was not the hindrance that it was in years past, where it was a big loss of your audience moving networks.
Now, post-SummerSlam has, for the last couple of years especially, been a really strong rating. You combine that with the offsetting factor of being on Sci-Fi. I mean, this was nonetheless, I mean, throw preemption and network out the window. This was the most viewed episode of Raw since the post-WrestleMania, which is what it would have been probably if it was on USA Network. So it's, you know, if you're WWE and you're changing networks, you've got to be happy to be able to tell your partner and say, look, we were on our unusual network. We're on Sci-Fi, which is a lower profile network than USA. It's in similar amount of homes though, but we were on an unusual network and it was like nothing happened almost.
Yeah, it was a very impressive number on Monday. There you go, everyone. Want to thank again, Patrick Ogier, for joining us. We'll be back in our normal time Wednesday at 3 Eastern as everything reverts back to normal next week as well. And that's all. You can catch myself over at postwrestling.com and postwrestlingcafe.com. Brandon is back on Sunday with WrestleNomics Radio. So check out that patreon.com/WrestleNomics. He's also got some analysis of market to market comparisons for WWE and AEW that you'll find very interesting, and see how both brands are performing during repeat visits to the same markets. So that's up there. And perhaps the mysterious files out of Texas, maybe they're going to see the light of day in the coming days/week. So look out for all of that on the WrestleNomics side, and we will speak with you next Wednesday.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.